Why? Okay, we are, the class tonight, I'll leave this here. The class tonight is second in our series of ethics. There is no class next week because we have frequent flyer miles that we have to use. So so we're going to see to the land of our people, Florida, and spend a few days there. And, yeah, how am I? The other land of our people, right? And so we're going to be away next week. But the weeks after, there are 3 weeks after, we have three series of very important classes. One is organ donation in Jewish ethics, which is obviously a very hot topic these days. When I picked it, it wasn't as hot, and now it's a very hot topic and very a very big debate and discussion going on as we speak. The second topic is, the following will be end-of-life issues and advanced directives. Also, I think a vitally important class for everybody to attend, and so if you can't attend, send proxy, and we'll find you. And finally, the last class, which was the original first class, but I got snowed out, which is the ethics of ransoming captives, the Gilad Shalit debate, Gilad Shalit, as it said. And as I mentioned before, when I was in Israel just in April, you turn on the television, and this is all they talk about. I shouldn't say all, there's other stuff too, but this is, you know, a major source of conversation, major source of debate about the whole Gilad Shalit delays. Do we go in? Do we try to save him? Do we risk this? What do we give up, et cetera, et cetera? And it is a major ethical dilemma, and so we should be a part of that discussion. Just a little caveat before we begin. We talk about ethics, right? So we're talking Jewish ethics. So people have, say, if I give a class on abortion, for example, right? So people have opinions on abortion based on their culture, based on their upbringing, based on their ideology, et cetera. Doesn't really matter what you think. It doesn't matter what I think. The class is about the Jewish view of abortion. So therefore, if you come in and say, I believe blank, right? So sometimes they're going to ask, what do you think? But other times, it doesn't really matter what you think. It doesn't matter what I think. Because the purpose of the class goes into what is the Jewish perspective, which is why we always work with the sources. Lauren, I have sheets for you. I'm sorry you tried to walk in discreetly. We're very laid back. Okay. So with that, the case is the following. Our class is called Lifeboat Ethics, and it is the case of the Siamese twins. The year was September of 1977. This was an actual case that came up, and it was written up by Rabbi Moses David Tendler, the son-in-law of Rabbi Moses Feinstein. Rabbi Moses Feinstein was the halachic decisor of Jewish law of the past generation. He passed away in 1986, if I'm not mistaken. He was asked this question. Rabbi Tendler is both a professor of Talmud and a professor of medicine at Yeshiva University, and a medical doctor. So, Rabbi Dr. Tendler. So the case is as follows. It says, early in September 1977, the drama began that added much kavod, much dignity, to the wisdom of Torah and to those who spend their lives applying Torah knowledge to the complex problems encountered daily in the modern world. In Lakewood, New Jersey, Siamese twins were born to a prestigious family of Torah educators. The twins were taken by helicopter on September 15th to the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, CHOP, a very famous children's hospital, where Dr. C. Everett Koop, you remember him? Yeah, sure. Subsequently became the Surgeon General of the United States, was then the hospital's chief of surgery. Immediately after the initial evaluation, it was obvious to all the physicians called in to evaluate that the twins, that both would die unless they were separated. However, the only way one child would be viable was if the other child was killed during surgeries. The question was referred to Rav Moshe Feinstein for his evaluation and decision. What we're going to do, I gave some of it away in the introduction, but we're going to study or analyze this case, right? This is, again, a case that happened in 1977, and it happened to Orthodox, traditional Jewish family of, and it says a prominent family of Torah educators. So therefore, the first question they do is they ask their rabbi. And the first thing the rabbi does is he goes to a higher authority. Rabbi Moses Feinstein was the highest authority of that at that time, and they say, "What do we do in this situation?" So again, the case is two babies are connected, born, connected by the heart, sharing a heart. The heart, and specifically, what does it say? It tells us they were The six chambers, correct.
Hello.
So, and you are now Dr. Koop. And the question is, what do you do in a situation like this? Okay? What are the ethics in this situation? This is a classic case of what we call lifeboat ethics. Not really a classic case. Classic case of lifeboat ethics is that you got basically two people on the boat and one life raft, right? And Titanic, right? So what do you do, right? So what do we do? What does our culture say we should do? What happened to the Titanic? Come on, we all saw the movie. Let's go.
Women were saved.
What? Women and children.
Women and children. Rich people went first because they cheated, right?
So the culture of society today is that women and children go for, get saved, right?
Is that Jewish?
Is that a Jewish ethic? We should know these things, just in case we're on the Titanic, right? Is that a Jewish ethic? What do we think? Is that a Jewish ethic? I like standing here. I feel very tall.
I hope it is.
Hope it is, right? That's because you're a woman. As a man, I don't think so, right? I'm like, no. Right? It is, where they discuss, it becomes a major issue when deciding who makes it and who doesn't. Right? We're going to be talking, when we talk about ransom and captives, a lot of these issues are going to come up, but at the end of the day, it's not so simple to say that women and children go first. In fact, it's really venture to say that's not the case. Sorry, Deborah. right? Don't go on a boat with me, right?
That's pretty much it.
So we're in this case now, right? Lifeboat ethics. We have a special case, as we said, halacha lemaaseh. This case actually happened in 1977. Two babies were born, Siamese twins sharing a heart chamber. And in order for one of them to survive, they had to kill the other baby. What do you do in this situation? So this is where your ethics come in, and then we'll get to study the tradition. What do we do in this situation?
Save the strongest.
Remember, there's two different things we're doing. One is saving. What's the other thing?
Killing.
That's the problem, right? Because to save, obviously, when you're doing triage, and that's also part of the ethics, right? You do triage. The triage is a term that comes up that you basically put people in three categories, right? And you say, these are who need immediate, these are who we can send the bill later, and these are whatever, somewhere in between, right? In Canada, since nobody, if you're, the rule in Canada is, if you're in really bad shape, you're in good shape, right? Because they're going to take care of you if you're in really bad shape. If you're in kind of whatever shape, we'll call you in about 6 months, right? That's what happens in Canada. Unfortunately, you go to the emergency room in Canada, it's an absolute zoo because that's what they work on triage all the time. It doesn't work on a first-come, first-served basis, right? Now, we're now in a situation. We have to make a horrible, horrible decision. Do we, in order to save a life, we have to take a life, okay? What do you do in this situation?
Cry.
You cry, right? You cry, you pray, and then you got to do something, right? And one of the things we do is we you know, you pray for a miracle, and then you try to bring one, right? That's a very important Jewish philosophy. We don't wait for the miracles to come down. We try to bring miracles. Okay. So what do you do, Kalia?
No.
They would both die.
If you do nothing, they both die. Okay, I stumped everybody. Look at that.
Do you really consider them two people if they're sharing a heart like that?
Very good question, right? Very good question. Are they really considered two people?
No.
Right? Are they really considered two people? So the Talmud actually has this case of two people, a person with two heads. And the question is if they're considered two people. So they say that if you hit one in one head, does the other head hurt? Right? So if it doesn't, then they're two people. That's one of the conclusions. There are cases of people, of Siamese twins in the past. There were cases of, I think in China, there was two grown men that were attached by the back, and they shared something. I forgot what it was, but they were attached by the back. There are obviously Siamese twins that are separated, right? That happens quite often. What was the problem here is that they were sharing some vital organs. So the question is what makes a person? Right? The conclusion seems to be fairly clearly that they were two separate people, and therefore both of them are considered alive. So there are two lives around here. Right? But it's a very good approach to say, well, maybe they're one person. If they're one person, then we could just kill off. You're allowed to amputate, so to speak, in order to save life. Right. Anyone else? Okay. So why don't we study, right? Just to look at the last paragraph, it says, it was clear to all concerned that this was a major ethical issue that had ramifications for the abortion debate and for ethics neonate salvage. The chief surgeon, a deeply religious man, was fully aware of the ethical import of any decision in the case. Dr. Koop referred to the case to the court so as to not have any accusation of premeditated murder leveled against him. Right? In addition, nurses and doctors at Children's Hospital consulted with the religious guides, and many reported back that they would not be able to participate in the surgery. They couldn't even get people to work on this case because it was so hotly debated. And eventually they were able to find, I believe Dr. Koop actually performed the surgery, and we'll get to the conclusion in just a moment. Okay, everybody with me? All right, yes, Deborah.
If you choose not to work on it and then both of them die, isn't that just bad?
Well, that's the question, right? Again, if you do nothing, they both die. If you do something, you're going to kill one of them, guaranteed. Okay? What is allowed, what's not? Let's look at the sources, okay? And most of the sources we're going to find are from the Talmud. If you look in the bottom of the first page, it says source number one, Talmud Bavli, tract Masechet Baba Metzia 62a. We'll read the English. It says two people were traveling, and only one of them had a canteen of water. Right? There was only enough water so that if both of them drank, they would both die. But if one of them drank, only he would be able to reach an inhabited area and live. There's a debate. First opinion is Ben Petura, who publicly taught better that both should drink and die, that one see his friend's death, until Rabbi Akiva, and that was what they believed, until Rabbi Akiva came and taught, your brother should live with you, based on the verse in Leviticus, your life takes precedence over the life of your friend. Okay? So again, what's the case? The case is two people walking in the desert, one of them has a flask of water, one of them doesn't. So the question is, if they both drink, if they share, right, then they're both going to die. So, says Ben Petura, better that they both don't drink, or they drink half of it, and see what happens, right? Until Rabbi Akiva said, no, the verse tells us that your brother shall live with you. So they say that it has to be with you, meaning if you're not around, your brother can't live with you. So better that you should live, and your life takes precedence over the life of your friend. So when we look at this case, right, does this tell us anything about our case over here?
Well, what does it even say about this case? I don't really understand.
The very interesting case is...
What is he saying?
He's saying that we have a debate, right?
He's saying that the one who owns the water should drink the water?
Yes. He who has the gold makes the rule, the golden rule.
I don't want to be on a boat with you and only one can't
do it. There you go. It's the golden rule. Who has the gold makes the rule. Now, if I have enough water to share with you and we're going to both survive, then I'm required to give you the water. The text says in Leviticus, the Bible tells us, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Thou shalt not stand by the blood of your friend. In other words, if you have the ability to save somebody's life, you're biblically required to do that. In English, what do we call that? The Good Samaritan, right? Because they say, oh, what a great person. In Judaism, we call that a mitzvah, because you're required to do it. It's not just like, oh, what a great guy. No, you're required. You can't just walk by. You're required, biblically required, to take care of somebody who's at risk, in danger, etc., right? So, now, I have, on the one hand, I have the biblical requirement to save this person. On the other hand, is that if I give it to him, I'm not going to make it. I'm going to die. So what do I do in this situation? So the first opinion says, no, you cannot. Because if you drink, you're basically killing this person. Right? And Rabbi Akiva says, no. Right? Even though you are basically killing this person, right? What's the problem is that, but your life takes precedence. So if you have a choice, then you should drink it. Now, this, yes, Alan.
The person's right back and try to get the water away.
Aha. So now here is what we have here. Then Alan picks up a point and says, wait a second, who has the water? Who has the water? I have the water, right?
Now.
Deborah, who's angry at me now, right, doesn't have the water. Now, if let's say Deborah comes in and takes a bat and hits me over the head and grabs the water, what do we call that?
Stealing.
We call it murder.
Okay.
Right? It's more than stealing. You took something that was mine, right, and you have led to my murder. Right? The difference is that I have, because it's my water. Now, if Deborah has the water, the positions would be the other way, and I'd be trying to raise some money and see if I can get the water from Deborah, but to buy it off her, right? But Deborah's not going to give it to me. Now, that is because she has the water. What happens if we both find a bottle of water? Now what do we do? Well, does it belong to both of us? Yeah, everybody remember that phrase, finders keepers, losers weepers, right? That's biblical, right? Because it says, as we said, he who has the gold makes the rules. So therefore, the first person to grab the water will then, it becomes their water, right? Until then, it belongs to no one. And therefore, either one can have it. And what happens, we can fight it out. And actually, there's a halachic case, what we call the alam gvar, which means let the strongest survival the fittest. Let the strongest one win. In a case like that, let the strongest one win. But in the case that we have here, it's my water. So if it's my water, so I have a choice. Do I basically give it to Deborah and let her live and let me die? Do I split it with her and let us both die? Or do I just drink it myself? Right? Well, those are our three options. None of the options say I should give it to my friend and let myself die. The only option is Membatura says that we should split it, because that way, and we should both die, right? And Rabbi Akiva disagreed. And Rabbi Akiva said, no, your life takes precedence over the life of your brother. Now, can we draw a parallel to this case? Can we draw a parallel
one
to this case?
The heart.
What?
The one who has more of the heart?
The one who has more of the heart. Except, what's the problem with that? So we say, let's say baby A has more of the heart. I think actually baby B had more of the heart. Baby B had more of the heart than baby A. Right? So is that, except, again, there's more, and then there's both holding on. So if the entire heart was in baby A, B, so then you would be right. Right? But if the only part of the heart is in baby B, and part of the heart is in baby A, so it's like the water. It's all or nothing. In other words, neither, each one of them has a hold on the heart. So it's not the water is, either they have all of the water or they have all of the heart. Can't say now they have both have part of the heart. That means both of them are holding enough water to survive. Well, they're holding some piece of the water that they need. So that doesn't work. What else is also different from this case? Yes, Alan.
There's a big difference between the one case, the first case, the doctors and the rabbis are making a decision for the Siamese twins, whereas in the other case, individuals are making decisions for themselves.
Correct. Now the babies can't make decisions for themselves, right? So we have to, someone has to make a decision for them, but there are other people involved, right? So that's a significant problem. There are other people involved. Now what do we do? You can't, so it's not that the parties involved are making that decision. What else?
Well, it's also a difference between an active and a passive action.
Why?
Well, if you're holding the bottle of water, you're not wrenching it away from me, and even though I will die, you are not physically killing me and then drinking the water.
Correct.
In order for the stronger baby to have the whole heart, you are literally going to kill that other baby.
So Rabbi Feinstein said exactly that. He said, I can't make a parallel to this case, because in this case, we have one, even if you held like Rabbi Akiva, which is how we conclude, that says he who has the gold makes the rules, and even if we said that the person who had most of the water, most of the hearts, would be sufficient, which we're not ready to say that, it still wouldn't be, we can't make that parallel. Why? Because in this case here, there's a passive, passively allowing someone to die. In the case that we have with the Siamese twins, the doctors have to actively kill this baby. And so you can make that parallel. Everybody with me? Good. Any other questions?
Well,
Let's move on to the next source. Okay? We're in source number two. This is from the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Sanhedrin, page 74a. It tells us the following. Again, we'll read it in English. It says, there was a person who came before Rabbah. Rabbah is not a female rabbi, but Rabbah was a person, and said to him, "What if I were told by the governor, kill this person, and if you don't, I will kill you." Okay? What does a guy put the gun to his head and says, "Kill this person, and if you don't, I will then your life, I will take your life." Okay? Rabbah replied, "You must be killed, and you shall not kill. Since who is to say that your blood is redder than his? Perhaps his blood is redder than yours." Okay? Again, you can't say that one person's life is more important than another person's life, which is why it's a legitimate problem for the Titanic case, where you say that women and children go first. It's very nice that you say this for women and children. It's very altruistic, and not to say that it's not a heroic thing to do. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily right, or definitely necessarily required, because who's to say their blood is redder than mine? Who's to say my blood is redder than theirs? I can't choose and say this person's life is more important than that person's life, right? And if that's the case, I disagree.
Saying that women and children go first is because we take care of the weaker.
Right.
That's what it stems from. It's not whose life is more valuable. It's that in our society,
in Jewish law,
yes,
I believe everybody would have to agree to that. Because that's not an inherent ethical decision. That is a decision that society says that this is something that we need. We'll need these people to take care of the children and the women, etc., blah, blah. But it's not necessarily and for Jewish ethics, it doesn't mean that that's what we're supposed to do. You understand? In other words, it's a decision that society has made, and everyone has to agree with it. If one person disagrees, he has a right, according to Jewish tradition, to disagree. Well, I think he's a jerk, but he has a right to disagree, because who's to say, again, based on our sources, who's to say their blood is redder than mine? Right? And this is, we have actually a case, this, unfortunately, I took a course called Halakhos and Halakha, which was a fascinating course, and these were the halachic responses that came up during the Shoah, during the Holocaust. And you had cases of people who would be able to switch names of lists, right? And this is what happened. This is actually an amazing case of an individual who went over to Rabbi Ostro. I'm forgetting his name. Pinchas Ostro, maybe it's Ostro. And who was basically the chief rabbi in the ghetto. In the Kovno ghetto. Eventually he survived and moved to the Far Rockaway over the years, and he wrote down his responses. And the case that he had this situation where this man came over to him and said, "I have a diamond that I've been smuggling, and I found out that my son is on this list to be transported, and I could use this diamond to get him off the list. But in order to get him off the list, I have to exchange him with another name on the list. Am I allowed to do that? This is my only son." This horrible, horrific, horrific story is that the rabbi said, "I don't have my books, I can't answer the question." And he kept bothering him and said, "Oh, rabbi, no, whatever." And he said, "No, I can't answer the question, I don't have my books with me." And the man turned and said, "I know you know the answer. I know you're not giving me an answer because you don't want to give me an answer, because you know, and therefore, when I make this decision to give my child up, because that's what the halachic decision was." Now, we'll get a chance to talk about Holocaust and Halacha, and it was a very, very difficult course to take. What was amazing to me was that people still asked questions during that period of time, and that they still had faith to ask this question. But this is where this issue comes up, to say, who is to say that this man's son, who he wants to save, who is to say his blood is redder than the next person's son, who is unfortunately going to be put on the list afterwards. And so what we have a rule, what we call Yaharog Va'al Ya'avor, which is, in situations like this, be killed versus rather than kill. Yaharog Va'al Ya'avor, be killed rather than killed. There are actually, according to Jewish law, there are only three what we call cardinal sins. There are three commandments that one is not allowed to transgress under any circumstances, including penalty of death. And those three commandments are?
Idolatry.
Adultery. And? We got this one right here. And murder, right? Idolatry, and murder. If you want, we can make it. I made it into a song, right? So there you go. These are the three cardinal sins. In other words, if any time someone says, kill this person, or rape this married woman, or whatever it is, right? Or I will kill you. I'm sorry. If someone says, eat non-kosher, or I will kill you, right? You're required to eat non-kosher. It's actually a mitzvah to eat non-kosher, right? However, if they say, rape this married woman or whatever it is, then you would be required to give up your life. Those are the three cardinal sins. So in this case, they say, because who's to say, and especially and specifically in murder, who's to say one whose blood is redder? So here's we have the case of taking one life in order to save another life. Right? Here he's saving his own life. So are you allowed to take one life in order to save another life? So we have the commentaries on this, Rashi and Tosfos. Rashi says, if you look at 2a, it says the king's decree forbidding murder should not be pushed aside. Who's the king? God. God says, right, it is forbidden to commit murder. Even though I need to save my life, I am required, I'm not allowed to push aside this law. Said Tosfot. Tosfot was the grandchildren of Rashi. He says, who says your blood is redder? They believe that in certain situations one can save his life through killing. For example, we learn that if a person is threatened with death, unless he allows himself to be thrown on a baby, he may choose to live. The rule does not apply to passive killing. He can say on the contrary. Who says that his blood is redder? Maybe my blood is redder, since he does not actively do anything. According to this, there is a distinction in Tosfot. Rashi says there's no distinction. You're not allowed to take a life. And Tosfot takes it one step further and says that I am not allowed to actively take a life, but if you force me to take a life, for example, he says, if you threw me and I fell on somebody and it killed them, right, I would not be responsible. Passively, I'm allowed to take a life because maybe my blood is redder. But actively, I'm not allowed to take a life. That's what we were saying before, is that here, what are we doing? We're actively taking a life. If we said, well, let's wait, right? Maybe if we wait 3 weeks, we'll see what happens, and we'll see, maybe one of them will expire, and then we'll be able to save the other life. That's one thing. So first thing Rabbi Feinstein asked is it possible that if we waited a few weeks, or 10 days, or whatever it is, that one would expire and the other would survive? And the answer is no. Because unless we're in surgery and have this done, as soon as one expires, their part of the heart will cease to function, and therefore the other baby would die. So you have to cross that one out as well. Okay, everybody with me? So we have to try a third approach. The third approach goes as follows. This is a very interesting case. This comes from Talmud Yerushalmi. For those who aren't familiar, there's a Babylonian Talmud and there's a Jerusalem Talmud. We study, interestingly enough, the Babylonian Talmud. That's the primary source of study. When you hear Talmud, we're usually referring to the Babylonian Talmud. It was codified later, and therefore it was edited better. And there was greater scholarship in Babylonia at the time, after the Second Temple. This is all between the 4th and the 6th century. The Jerusalem Talmud was not edited as well, and so we use it as a reference, but we usually don't conclude like the Jerusalem Talmud. Okay, but here we have a case in the Jerusalem Talmud as follows. It says, we learned that groups of people were traveling on the road and they encountered non-Jewish bandits who said, give us one of yours and we will kill him. And if you don't, then we will kill all of you. And then even if all would be killed, they should not give over anyone. Okay, what's our case? Right? They say, we want a Jew. Give us a Jew. So what do you do in that situation? You say, I can't give anybody. Why? Because who's to say his blood is redder than others? What happens if one person stands up and says, no, I'm willing to do it? What do we do? If one person stands up and says, I'm willing to give up my life to save the whole city, what do we do?
What?
Thank you.
You say thank you. You make a day, and every day that on his birthday you have a big celebration, right? And a big l'chaim. You put a statue in the middle of the town and say, "Way to go, Joe!" Whatever it is, and then you walk away, right? He's allowed to do that. Nothing wrong with that. He's a hero. There is an opinion that says he's a fool, actually. But you know, again, this happens. You know, you have a you know, the people, the old stories of the volcano, right? You need a human sacrifice to save the town.
Yeah.
So who's the one who's willing to do it? The guy is the dunk of the town. They give me whatever. Either way, right? We don't look for the dunk of the town. If one person's willing to do this, great. But if no one's willing to do this, right, you cannot choose anyone. Because who's to say that your blood is redder than anyone else's? Right? Even if you don't like him. Even though it can happen. Right? So let's continue. It says, what if the attackers specified a victim? And they say, we want Joe. Right? Such is the case of Sheva ben Bichri, which we're going to read in just a second. Then the group should be give him over and not be killed. Now, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, only if the victim is liable for death like Sheva ben Bichri. And Rabbi Yochanan said, even if he's not liable for death like Sheva ben Bichri. Now, what is the case of Sheva ben Bichri? Let's look at the next source. Okay? Source number 4, if you look in the middle of the page, it says, it has the English, and we'll go through the English. Where they have it in the middle of the third page. The word, it starts with, now there happened to be there a base fellow. Anybody was in my class the other day and during the day? No, I think whatever. We happened to just to study the story. Okay? There happens to be, this is from Samuel 2, second book of Samuel, chapter 21. Is that true? Chapter 20, alright, and this is the end of David's reign. David had been king for a number of years. He had staved off many rebellions from his children, many issues. David had a very difficult life, and then comes along, right near the end, some schnook shows up and starts making trouble. And his name was Sheva ben Bechri, and he came from the tribe of Benjamin. Why was that significant? Because Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. When Saul lost his kingdom, and David took over, so the people from Benjamin got ticked off, because they used to be important people, they were from the tribe of the king, and then they became nobodies again, right? So they weren't too happy about this, and this is not the first time that one of the Benjaminites spoke up. And sure enough, it's interesting that he does this now, after many years, but this guy shows up, and there happened to be, there was a base fellow, his name was Sheva, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite, and he blew the horn, and he said, "We have no portion to David, neither have we inheritance of the son of Jesse, every man to his tents, O Israel." So all the men of Israel went up from following David and followed Sheva the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah did cleave unto their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. Right? So basically, they started rebellion. It happens, you know, in the news, like 6 times a week these days. And verse 6, David said to Avishai, "Now will the Sheva, the son of Bichri, do us more harm than Absalom?" Absalom was David's son who started a rebellion. He said, "We gotta take thou Lord's servant to pursue after them, lest they get fortified into a fortified city." Remember, at the time there were walled cities, right? You get into a walled city, it's gonna be a big deal to try to break down the walls in a walled city. So they were always running the walled city. Sure enough, they went to the tribes. Verse 14, and he went through all the tribes of Israel until Abel and to Ben Makkah and all the Berites. And they were gathered together, and they went in after him. And they came and besieged him in the city of Abel of Beth Makkah. And they cast up a mound against the city, which is what we call a battering ramp. Everybody remember this from, you know, from the movies, right? And it stood in the moat, and all the people that were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. So basically, this guy started a rebellion. The rebellion went bad. Now he's running away. They went after him, and he found himself safe in a walled city, in the city of Abel Makkah, whatever it's called, Beth Makkah. And so now the army comes along, led by Yoav, who is the head of the general of the army, and they're trying to knock down the wall. Then cried a wise woman out of the city, and she said, "Hear ye, hear, hear, say, I pray you, unto Joab, come near hither." That's how they spoke. And, "Oh, Romeo, come near hither, that I may speak with thee." And he came near unto her, and the woman said, "Art thou Joab?" And he answered, "Yep." And then she said unto him, "Hear the words of thy handmaid." And he answered, "Okay, speak up." Then she spoke, saying, they were wont to speak in old time, saying that they shall surely ask counsel to Abel, and so they ended the matter. "We are of them that are peaceable and faithful in Israel.
Seekest thou to destroy a city and a mother in Israel? Meaning, question mark, meaning you're going to wipe us all out just because of the schnook who ran into our city, right? Why will you swallow up the inheritance of God? And Yoav answered and said, you're right, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. The matter is not so, but a man of the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against the king, and even against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. We want him. We don't need anybody else. We're not going to make trouble. And the woman said unto Yoav, behold, his head shall be thrown to thee over the wall. Then the woman went unto all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba the son of Bichri, and threw it out unto Yoav over the wall, and he blew the horn, and they were dispersed in the city, every man to his tent, and Joab returned to Jerusalem unto the king. End of story. Okay, now, let's break down this beautiful biblical story of headless men, and say, well, what's the deal? So, the deal is, they went after somebody, they said, we want Sheba ben Bichri. She said, excuse me, and if you don't give us Sheba ben Bichri, we're going to kill you all. She says, so what does she do? She negotiates, and apparently Sheba ben Bichri agreed. I don't know, or he didn't agree, it didn't really matter. And they killed him, and they saved everybody else. Were they allowed to do that? Yoav wasn't disappointed, he seemed to be very happy. Everybody else seemed to be very happy. Were they allowed to do that? Seems to be, everything was hunky-dory, right? How come they were allowed to do that? Didn't we just say in the text that he say, give us a Jew, and you're not allowed to hand over a Jew, right? You can't take a Jew and say, give us a Jew. So why was he allowed to do that? Why were they allowed to do that?
Because
they asked for Sheba ben Bichri. They asked for Sheba ben Bichri, right? Since they said, we want Joe, give us Sheba ben Bichri, so that was okay. That was sufficient to say that you can kill him in order to save everyone else. If they said, give us a Jew, no good. But if they said, give us this guy, then it's good. What's the difference? What is distinctive? In other words, when we see a case, when you look at law, right? Do you have any attorneys here? You're a doctor, it's almost like an attorney, right? In the United States, everybody gets sued, right? So, what we do when we see an attorney, when you have a case, you look at a case, you look for precedent. In other words, you take the precedent and you say, can I look at this locally or can I look at this globally? Right? Can I take this and make this a global case and learn from this precedent that says any time that they specifically say we want one guy, one particular guy, we want Sheba ben Bichri, then you're allowed to kill Sheba ben Bichri. Right? And if they, can we say that globally, that's anything, or we say it's a local case? And say we can only say this specifically for this type of case. And what type of case was this? What type of case was this?
He was a criminal,
right? He was Mored B'Malchut, he was rebelling against the king. He started a rebellion. You know what they do, according to Jewish law, for people who start rebellions? They chop off their head. I mean, they basically kill them, right? Not basically, they do. So, do we say that this case is local and you cannot generalize because it was only a case of Sheba ben Bichri, a case when they were out to get him, to kill him, because he deserved death. Or he was a criminal, deserved death. But if it was a regular person, would not be the case, right? Or do we say otherwise? And we say no. Anytime it's a case where they specify, we can say globally that it works. And we can choose that person. Everybody understand the question? Let's look back at that page before that we saw in source number 3. There's a debate. Yes. Let me just finish this. Okay? There's a debate between Rav Shimon. Let's see those two lines. Rav Shimon ben Lakish said, only if the victim is liable for death like Sheba ben Bichri. And Rabbi Yochanan said, even if it's not liable death, like Sheba ben Bichri. We have a debate. Do we make it a local case, or do we make it a global case? Can we say it's any time we have somebody specified, or do we say, no, it has to be only someone who is rebelled against the king, or is deserving the death penalty?
Yeah, that's my question.
Okay. Good. We answered it. Okay? So now we don't know what to do, because we have a debate. What do you do in debates? You flip a coin, right? So that's how we resolve all major issues, right? You bring it to class. So this happens to be, interestingly enough, just a little background to appreciate this. Sometimes you say, when you study Talmud, you have to know who's saying what. So just to appreciate this, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish was Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan was the great rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan, and Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, actually used to be a bandit. Used to be a thief. Talmud tells us that he was a thief, and that he was once, the story that he was running, he stole something and the police were after him, and he was running away, and he got to a brook, a stream, and he jumped over the stream, and he was able to leap over the stream, and the police that were chasing him weren't able to catch him. And Rabbi Yochanan witnessed this, saw him as he went over back over the stream, and he said, such strength that you have, could you imagine if you had dedicated your life to studying and serving the Jewish people? And he said, really, you think so? And he said, yeah. He said, well, how, story in the Talmud. He said, but I'm a bandit. How am I ever going to find a shidduch? Who's going to marry me, right? So he said, Rabbi Yochanan was known to be extremely good looking, it says. He says, if you think I'm good-looking, you should see my sister. And so he introduced him to his sister, and Reish Lakish, Rav Shimon ben Lakish, was what we call Chozer B'Tshuvah. He became observant and a Talmudic scholar, and he became the study partner of Rav Yochanan, as well as his brother-in-law. It's interesting to note, if you look at this, Rav Shimon ben Lakish, who used to be a bandit, used to be from the other side of his tracks, he said, no. You can't make this a general case. If the guy is a crook, you know, if he's a criminal, that's when you punish him, right? Because he knows. He's been on the other side of the tracks. He's been there. Rabbi Yochanan, he grew up in a little cocoon over there. He says, no, why don't we just make this a general rule? And so that's where the debate comes in. What's fascinating is, and if you didn't find that as exciting as I did, I'm sorry, but I like this stuff. If you look at the final page, page number 4, okay, you'll have Maimonides, who says the following. Says, under this case, says, similarly, if the non-Jews said to them, to the group of Jews, give over one of you so we can kill him or else we will kill all of you, they must all allow themselves to be killed and not give to them a Jewish soul. If they designated a specific Jew and said, give us pony, so-and-so, or we will kill all of you, if the person was deserving of death like Sheva ben Rikri, then they could give him over, but we do not instruct them to do this. If the person was not deserving of death, then everyone must allow themselves to be killed and not give over a Jewish soul. So, Maimonides concludes like Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish and says, we cannot hand over somebody, kill somebody, unless they were a criminal, like the case of Sheva ben Bichri. So if you take this to our case now, as Rabbi Feinstein said, can we apply this case to our case? Well, in our case, we're going to kill baby A in order to save baby B, right? Are we allowed to do that? Well, baby A is really baby A. We're trying to save baby B, so we're trying to kill baby A, right? Why wouldn't we say we could do that? That's exactly what we're going to kill one to save the other. In the case of Sheva ben Bichri, it works, but it doesn't work because baby A didn't do anything wrong. It's not a criminal. It's only unfortunate the crime, so to speak, is that he was born in a very terrible situation. But he can't say that he did anything wrong, so therefore we cannot draw a parallel to this case. Rabbi Feinstein concluded finally, based on source number 6 and 7, and said the following. And this is from the Mishnah in Ohalot, and tells us the case of, this becomes relevant in the case of abortion, as well as a case what we call the case of a rodef. Now in this last week's portion, we're not studying abortion now, we'll get a chance to study it at a different time. In last week's portion, the case is the verses that discuss abortion. Specifically, if you read the Greek translation of the Bible, which is starts with an L, Septuagint. Thank you. Starts with, you read the Septuagint. I'm getting older. It's my problem. Right? If you read the Septuagint, you will see where they differ in the translation and why they conclude what they conclude about abortion. They are very strict about abortion, while actually Jews are much more liberal compared to the Catholic Church about abortion. But here it tells us the following. So let's say you have a case. If a woman is in difficulty during childbirth, it is permissible to destroy the fetus surgically because her life comes first. Right? That is Jewish law. Catholic law?
The other way around.
Catholic law is I don't know the other way around, but they will not kill one to save the other. I don't know if they'll kill the mother.
The child's life takes precedence.
Really? Interesting. I remember there was a movie, one of those made-for-TV movies that made everybody cry, you know, the CBS movies, whatever it is, right? There was a movie about, a TV movie called Those She Left Behind, and there was a movie about a woman who they allowed her to die in order to save the baby. The baby survived, she didn't, and they could have saved her, but they didn't because of religious conviction, right? And it was... In any case, it is here in Jewish law, it's permissible to abort the child in order to save the mother's life. If, however, the head of the fetus had already been delivered, then it is forbidden to intercede, even though it may cost the life of the mother. It's forbidden once the baby crowns, right? Then it's because that's where life begins. That's when the child is no longer, even if it's half inside the mother, half out, so to speak. It doesn't matter. Because their life had already begun, they're no longer an extension of the mother anymore. Therefore, the fetus is now an infant with the ability for an independent life, therefore we do not sacrifice one life to save another. So we have a category called a rodef. A rodef became very, unfortunately, that the term became very popular into the vernacular of society because that was the reason why Yigal Amir killed Yitzhak Rabin. Remember, he said that he was a rodef. A rodef means a pursuer. If, according to Jewish law, if you see somebody pursuing someone else with a knife and they're trying to kill them, you're allowed to kill them first. And Yigal Amir used that as his rationale, incorrectly, by the way, to commit murder and kill Yitzhak Rabin, saying that he was in a category of a rodef. So that's where the New York Times picked that up, and unfortunately it became, everybody knew, oh, rodef, of course, that's what Jews do. Anyway, in this case, this is a case of a rodef. In other words, is that if the child is inside the mother, then the child is considered a rodef, right? Even though we consider it a life. We do consider it a life. The child has a life, sort of exists, but it's not independent, therefore you're allowed to kill the baby. Once the child is now crowned and the head is out, it's not the case, and it's basically they have to fight it out. We cannot kill one to save the other, which is, again, a similar case that we have here. The Talmud tells us something interesting. It said, why should you not sacrifice the infant, even though the head is already presented, since the infant is endangering the life of his mother? Is not the infant then a rodef, a pursuer? The law of the pursuer should apply, which is to kill the pursuer in order to save the life of the victim. The Gemara concludes, no. Heaven is the pursuer. In other words, is that would only work if the person had their own volition. In other words, they had their own intent to kill. But here, no, heaven is the one with the intent to kill, and therefore you're allowed to therefore you're not allowed to take this life. Now, Rabbi Feinstein took this and used this rationale and said that in this situation, what we have here as well is that heaven is the pursuer. He concluded that said that if they kill baby, they wanted to kill baby A in order to save baby B. They said if they killed baby B, would baby A survive? The answer was no. So then he said, and applied this rule, that heaven is the pursuer, and therefore heaven is going after baby A. It's as if baby A is already going destined to die, and for that reason he concluded that you're allowed to kill baby A in order to save baby B.
And also baby B had red blood.
Well, I guess, practically speaking, had better redder blood.
Literally
speaking, had redder blood. Right? In this really amazing case that was, in 1977, I don't want to tell you how old I was, so whatever, but maybe you might have remembered the case. In the case, this is actually what happened. They did the surgery. They weren't able to get the first set of nurses. They quit and walked out, and they wouldn't perform the surgery. They had to get another set of nurses. Rabbi, they performed the surgery. They did kill baby B, A. Baby B survived the surgery. Unfortunately and tragically, I think 5 weeks later, had an infection, and baby B died as well, which is a very sad story. But the way Rabbi Tendler tells the story, and I heard this from him live, he shared the story when I was in rabbinical school, and he told, when we went through all the sources, where I learned it with him, He said what was amazing was the following. He said that this basically took over. I mean, groups, ethical groups and ethicists were bouncing around all over the place. This was being discussed right and left. It was in the news. And I don't know, again, I wasn't watching the news at the time, but it was in the news, 1977. And he said that Dr. Koop was sitting in this room with a bunch of ethicists and said, "You don't know what to do, and I don't know what to do. And the only one who knows what to do is this little rabbi from the Lower East Side of Manhattan." Rabbi Feinstein was 4'11". He was a little rabbi, right? He said, "And until he tells us what to do, we will do nothing and wait for his decision." And so, to the way Rabbi Tendler said, it was such an amazing, what we call a kiddush Hashem, a sanctification of God's name, that they recognized that there are certain things you have to just go to the highest authority. Rabbi Feinstein, when he made this decision, never published it, by the way. Rabbi Tendler only published it later. I think it might have been after Rabbi Feinstein had passed. And Rabbi Feinstein refused to publish it, and it said that he fasted for 3 days after he made this decision, obviously one of probably the most heart-wrenching decisions he ever made. But for the world, and for C. Everett Koop, who later became the attorney, the Surgeon General, to be able to say that it is this little rabbi who knows what God wants, what's the right thing to do. Unfortunately, through that tragedy was an amazing, amazing story that came out for as a highlight of what Jewish tradition is all about. Any questions that we have? Oh, okay. Well, again, I hope you enjoyed it. If anybody has any questions, feel free to ask. Yes, Cindy?
I have a question, but it seems like it's a validation of the theory that God is dissociating.
Unfortunately. Well, hindsight is 20/20, but it was heart-wrenching story. You can only imagine what this family had gone through. But they said, you know, they said we're gonna wait till see what the rabbi tells us, and he had to go through all of this in order to be able to make a decision like this. He had to go through everything to be able to rule out and decide what is right and what is wrong. Yes.
There was an article.